You're listening to 103.1 FM and 980 AM WPFP Park Falls. This is Trail Mix 103.1.
Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around.
Trail Mix 103.1.
And you can dance.
In your eyes. I can do a total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
FM.
This week on Viewpoints.
They don't have pensions. They don't have savings. They don't really have a safety net and wind up on our streets where we know they die at extraordinarily high rates.
Why we're failing tens of thousands of older Americans. Then,
today, it's estimated that 4.4 million individuals cannot vote because of their felony convictions.
Will former President Donald Trump be able to cast a ballot this November? I'm Marty Peterson.
And I'm Gary Price. These stories in depth this week on your public affairs magazine, Viewpoints.
Nowadays, most value menus are just kind of menus, unless you're at KFC. With Taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy drumming thigh, hand-breaded in 11 herbs and spices, a side of creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit for just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. Taste of KFC deals. Available all day, every day. Only at KFC. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tips, and fees extra.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
Last week, in the first half of the show, we talked about why a rising number of older Americans are ending up on the streets. If you missed it, two big factors driving this crisis are inflated prices in the housing market and the rising costs of everyday essentials like groceries, gas, and electricity. These growing expenses can be catastrophic for older adults who are on a fixed budget, leading to some grim outcomes. Believe it or not, those 50 and older are the fastest growing group affected by homelessness, according to a late 2023 Department of Housing and Urban Development report. And many in this situation are out on the streets for the first time in their lives. Today, this segment makes up almost half of the overall homeless population in the country. Dr. Margot Cushell emphasizes how oftentimes other looking from the outside in are quick to draw conclusions about how people got to this point.
To be clear, older adults who become homeless, if you've never been homeless before the age of 50, you are not becoming homeless because you've got a lifelong substance use or mental health problem. That's just not your story. Your story is really deep poverty that comes about because of how poorly we pay workers. And for people who are working these low-wage, physically demanding jobs, we have a society that expects for people to work, 80 hours a week in order to have any chance of making their rent. They don't have pensions. They don't have savings. They don't really have a safety net. And they just really run out of room and wind up on our streets where we know they die at extraordinarily high rates.
Cushell is a primary care physician and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. For many years, she studied vulnerable populations and the many effects of homelessness. In older adults who are low income, she's seen firsthand how one health issue, injury, or unforeseen life event can quickly spiral into homelessness. And once a person is in this situation, it's really hard to get back.
By the age of 50, our research has shown that people experiencing homelessness have the health problems, the functional problems that we usually see in housed adults in their 70s and 80s. By the age of 50, people experiencing homelessness are much more likely to experience difficulty walking, difficulty doing their activities of daily living, cognitive problems, and other problems we usually associate with old age.
Out on the streets, people age faster because of the poor living conditions, lack of food, and little to no access to preventative health care. Cushell says that if you look at someone who's 55 years old and has been homeless for 5 years, it's not uncommon to see the same health problems as someone who's 75. Dennis Culhane, a professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania, highlights how this early onset of health problems places an extraordinary strain on emergency room departments, hospitals, and social services.
A disproportionate number of people in emergency rooms are people who are experiencing homelessness. And then because they've not had access to basic health care, they're often, again, hospitalized. And then they have to stay in a hospital longer than the typical patient because they can't be sent home to recover and be cared for in home. So they end up staying longer, costing more. But yet at the end of the day, they are discharged back to homelessness. We're not using these key opportunities, like when someone is hospitalized, as an opportunity to solve their homelessness problem. So we're contributing to the revolving door by ignoring the underlying sort of social determinant of their health services, which is that they don't have somewhere to live, they can't organize routine care or take care of themselves, with daily needs. And it's a sad, tragic situation, and it's not good for them, it's not good for society, it's not good for taxpayers.
Since hospitals are a temporary band-aid and not a permanent solution, these people are often prematurely placed in state-run nursing homes or are shipped back to homeless shelters, both of which are already overwhelmed and don't have the necessary resources to properly care for them. Many homeless shelters have bunk beds, communal showers, and tight spaces that aren't safe for older Americans with health issues.
In some cases, this causes shelters to have to turn people away, knowing that they're not safe for them. But then that elder instead is left living outside on our streets.
With no one to turn to and nowhere left to go, many in this group live out their last days cold, hungry, suffering, and in pain. In some cases, they're targeted and assaulted because they're too weak to fight back.
Our studies have shown astronomically high death rates. Interestingly, if you look at the people 50 and over who are homeless, if you were first homeless after 50, you're at an even higher risk of dying than those folks who were first homeless before 50 and remained homeless.
In the end, it all comes back to a lack of affordable housing. Millions of Americans are being priced out of their rentals and homes because of continuously rising costs. For lower-income older adults living paycheck to paycheck or on a fixed retirement income, this can all too quickly lead to homelessness.
There is no county in this country where people can afford to live on a minimum wage. In California, where I live, there are only 24 units of housing that are available and affordable for every 100 extremely low-income households. Extremely low-income households are households that make less than 30% of the area median income. What we see is just this abdication of responsibility. Only one in four households that meet the very strict criteria to receive rental assistance receive it.
Culhane agrees with Cushell and says that there needs to be big policy changes in Washington. These people have worked hard for decades, and now we're letting them fall through the cracks.
There needs to be a political coalition of folks who agree that we should not have elderly or disabled people living destitute on our streets. And about 60% of the adult homeless population is either elderly or disabled. And it means our social insurance system is broken and it's going to have to be fixed. We need to develop more political will to fix the safety net for elderly and disabled people.
To find out more about this topic, links to resources and our guests, Dr. Margo Cushell and Dennis Culhane, head to viewpointsradio.org. The story was written and produced by our executive producer, Amira Zaveri. Our studio manager is Jason Dickey. I'm Gary Price. This segment is brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy, plus get access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Coming up, should Americans with felony convictions be able to vote when Viewpoints returns?
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today? Ah, starting trouble. No one likes that. We can get you set up for some stronger starts. You might just need a fresh charge, and we can take care of that free of charge. But if it is time for a new battery, we've got replacement batteries that'll fit your needs, starting at just $79.99. That's what makes us America's number one battery destination.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down. Covered by the Verizon 5G network. And for less than $30 a month, we make your phone your ride or die. Switch now and pick a free 5G phone with qualified plan purchase. And your fourth line at no additional cost. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you. Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see TotalWireless.com.
Nowadays, most value menus are just kind of menus, unless you're at KFC. With Taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy drumming thigh, hand-breaded in 11 herbs and spices, a side of creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit for just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. Taste of KFC deals, available all day, every day, only at KFC. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tips, and fees, extra.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Why are certain providers and medical doctors not listening to family members who have lived through a disease path for such a long time?
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
May, Donald Trump became the first former U.S. president to be convicted of a felony. As a current presidential candidate, questions began swirling if he'd be able to continue his campaign. Turns out there are no laws barring those with felony convictions from running for president. But there are laws preventing them from voting. This means that in November, Trump may join millions of Americans who are unable to cast a vote.
Today, it's estimated that 4.4 million individuals cannot vote because of their felony convictions. This figure, it includes both individuals who are currently incarcerated, but also folks who are formerly incarcerated as well. And so perhaps to contrary public perception, the vast majority of individuals that are still disenfranchised are out of prison and have completed their sentences, including probation, parole, or any other community supervision.
That's Reginald Thedford Jr., legal counsel on the Restore Your Vote team at the Campaign Legal Center, a nonprofit government watchdog group. Right now, laws in 48 states prevent people with felony convictions from voting. In 22 states, voting rights are only restricted while in prison. This includes New York, where Trump was convicted. In 15 states, parole and probation must be completed before voting rights are restored. And in 11 states, voting rights are still denied even after completing prison, parole, or probation sentences. While the majority of states restore voting rights after a sentence is finished, this process is much harder than many realize.
You have to finish your term of parole or your term of probation. And that's something that we've been trying to draw attention to in general, because probation and parole have some pretty strict requirements that are often basically setting up people to fail when you also consider how difficult it is to reenter society from prison. Because, for instance, if you're on parole, you're coming back from prison, you have to, in many states, you have to maintain housing, you have to maintain employment, you have to do regular check-ins with your parole officer, you have to pay pretty steep fees. Meanwhile, on probation, which is an alternative sentence to incarceration, people on probation typically have anywhere from 18 to 20 different requirements that they have to comply with on any given day.
That's Wanda Bertram, communications strategist at the Prison Policy Initiative. On top of completing probation or parole, in states like Florida, criminal justice debt must be paid before voting rights are fully restored. These requirements make it very difficult, if not impossible, for many to restore this freedom. But those with felony convictions aren't the only ones facing barriers to voting. Bertram says that many people in jail on election day also can't vote, even though they haven't been convicted of a crime.
It's less well known, but it's still important that people who are not necessarily convicted of a crime, but who happen to be in jail on election day, are effectively barred from voting. So local jails, you know, your local county jail holds people mostly who are being held pre-trial. They haven't been convicted yet. And most of those folks in most states, we've estimated, are still voter eligible by law. On election day this November, there's going to be about 650,000 people across the country who are being held in local jails. And most of those people are voter eligible, but they won't be able to cast a ballot.
While some people support expanding voting rights to those currently and previously incarcerated, others maintain that not having this right is an appropriate punishment for committing a crime. If people with criminal convictions disregard the law, why should they have a say in the lawmaking process?
The most common argument about taking the franchise away from people who are convicted of felonies is, by committing a crime against society, you have lost your right to participate in the society. And that's an argument that actually extends past voting and has also been used to justify things like prohibiting people with felony convictions from serving on juries, right? Which means that some of the people who are most knowledgeable about the criminal justice system and its perils and its errors are not able to be part of the criminal procedure.
Another critique is that by breaking the law, people convicted of crimes have shown that they don't care about participating in civic life. But there's actually evidence that this isn't true. In 2019, Cook County Jail in Chicago became the country's first jail-based polling place, and voter turnout surprised many experts.
Studies are showing that folks incarcerated at Cook County are voting at higher rates than the actual city of Chicago. And so what we're seeing is this debunking of the theory or idea that folks incarcerated don't want to participate, they lack the knowledge, to whatever it may be.
That being said, if you commit a crime, there are going to be consequences. However, it's important to remember that prisons are supposed to rehabilitate, not just punish. Thedford says that allowing people with felony convictions to vote helps them reintegrate into communities and feel like productive members of society rather than outcasts.
There are studies that show that restoration increases success on reentry and makes people feel part of their community and ultimately increasing public safety. And what we want and what we want to prioritize for folks who are incarcerated is rehabilitation rather than punishment. And I think we've gotten so used to in America with our criminal legal system to punish individuals that we forget that in order for folks to come out and be productive members of society, we need to increase practices and methods that provide rehabilitation.
He adds that current voting restrictions also disproportionately affect people of color. On average, African-American adults are excluded at a rate that's 3 times higher than all other Americans.
We know that Black people are disproportionately locked up. And in addition, if you look at the states that still have harsh voter disenfranchisement laws on the books, there are states like Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama, states that are well known for having high rates of incarceration, and particularly states that have large Black populations.
And none of this is going unnoticed. On both the state and federal level, progress is being made to expand voting rights to people with felony convictions. While it doesn't look like any bills will pass before November, it's promising that significant change will be made for future elections.
At the federal level, there have been a few pieces of legislation that have been introduced. One, the Democracy Restoration Act, which has been introduced for several years. And essentially, that would reenfranchise folks who have not finished probation and parole, but those who are living in their communities and no longer incarcerated. At the state level, there have been several wins over the last few years, and there's actually a trend for expanding access to the ballot for folks with felony convictions.
Just this year, California, New York, Massachusetts, Illinois, and Oregon have introduced bills with provisions to expand voting rights. And in addition to legislation, governors of states like Virginia and Kentucky have issued executive orders that have re-enfranchised thousands of people convicted of felonies. Bertram says these steps will all help to strengthen American democracy. As a country, she believes we need more voices to be heard, not less.
We are nearly unparalleled as a democracy in how few people turn out to vote. We need more people coming out to vote, not fewer, right? And in particular, if we want to be pushing for social justice, we need more people coming out to vote. So these are really counterproductive laws from that standpoint. It's also just unfair. There's, you know, when you commit a crime, you receive a sentence. That sentence is your punishment. The judge does not, you know, say, and in addition, I don't want you to vote. And there's a good reason why they can't say that. They can't say it because that is a basic right that is enshrined in our Constitution for everyone. No matter what you did, you should be able to cast a ballot.
To find out more about Reginald Thedford Jr., Wanda Bertram, and all our featured guests, visit viewpointsradio.org. For more behind the scenes and to support our show, follow Viewpoints Radio on X, Facebook, and Instagram. This segment was written and produced by Grace Galanti. Our executive producer is Amira Zaveri. Studio production by Jason Dickey. I'm Marty Peterson.
Viewpoints returns in just a moment.
Life hack number 7, get an iPhone 12 on Straight Talk.
Life hack.
Here's how it works. You walk into Walmart, go to the electronics section, ask for iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system, and select the new Silver Unlimited plan. They'll smile because it's a good plan. You get real unlimited data all for just $20 a month for the whole first year. Get it at Walmart or StraightTalk.com. Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Taxes and fees apply. Requires activation of iPhone 12 and a new Silver Unlimited plan or higher end auto pay enrollment. $25 a month service credit applied for up to 12 months if eligibility requirements are met. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com.
Nowadays, most value menus are just kind of menus, unless you're at KFC. With Taste of KFC deals, you can get a hot, juicy drumming thigh, hand-breaded in 11 herbs and spices, a side of creamy mashed potatoes and gravy, and a flaky, buttery biscuit for just $4.99. Son of a bucket, that's a good deal. Taste of KFC deals, available all day, every day, only at KFC. It's finger-licking good. Prices, participation, and product offering may vary. Tax, tips, and fees, extra.
The
This is Viewpoints Explained. I'm Ebony McMorris. Extreme, unrelenting heat during the summer months is just part of the new norm in many areas across the South and West, where it was already hot to begin with and now feels unbearable to be outside for even a few minutes. So far this summer, more than 2,500 towns across the U.S. have matched or broken their all-time heat records. Earlier this month, Palm Springs in California topped a new high of 124 degrees. Las Vegas in Nevada also set a record of 120 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. And it's not just singular days or weeks of extreme heat anymore. In many communities, these triple-digit temperatures are lingering for months. Last year, more than 2,300 people died from complications stemming from excessive heat exposure. This is an all-time record for heat-related deaths, according to the CDC data. Yet experts are already predicting that this year will end in a high number. If you're heading outside, even if it's for 20 or 30 minutes, take extra precautions. Always pack more water than you think, wear light-colored, breathable clothing, and tell at least two people where you're going. Keep an eye out for symptoms of heat exhaustion like heavy sweating, nausea, dizziness, muscle spasms, and red skin patches that appear in clusters. That's Viewpoints Explained for this week. More in a moment.
Welcome to Culture Crash, where we examine what's new and old in entertainment. The New York Times recently published a list of the 100 greatest books of the 21st century so far. Admittedly, I haven't read all of the books on the list, but I have read a bunch. The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay is incredible. Ditto The Road by Cormac McCarthy. But inevitably, the list just made me think about some of my favorite books that didn't get a mention. So here are three more of the best books of the century, according to me. First, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer tells the story of Oscar, a precocious 9-year-old boy who lost his father in 9/11 and is on a quest to find what lock is opened by a strange key his father left behind. The novel also features a timeline about Oscar's grandparents and the firebombing of Dresden during World War II. It includes plenty of tender, open-hearted writing that will absolutely devastate you, but in exactly the right way. The second book on my list is I'm Thinking of Ending Things by Ian Reid, which is maybe the most unsettling book I've ever read. And I read a lot of horror. The book is about a man bringing his girlfriend to meet his parents on their farm for what turns out to be a creepy and disastrous trip. Full of tension and musings on the nature of a relationship heading south, Reid's novel is short enough to read in one sitting, but creepy enough that I had to put it down a few times. And finally, my favorite book of the century to date is Stephen King's 11/22/63. King himself submitted a ballot for the New York Times list and controversially included a work of his own, Under the Dome. But for my money, 11/22/63 is the superior work. The novel is about a man who goes through a time portal to 1958 to stop the assassination of John F. Kennedy. While that's the premise, the trick of the book is that it's actually just about living in the past. Full of rich details from the 50s and 60s, 11/22/63 is at times a romance and at times a pulse-pounding sci-fi novel that doesn't overstay its welcome, even at 849 pages. Interestingly, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and 11/22/63 have all been adapted to the screen. But I don't think any of those adaptations come even close to the magic of the source novels. And I think even viewers of those adaptations will find plenty to love in the original texts. I'm Evan Rook.
Life hack number 7. Get an iPhone 12 on Straight Talk.
Life hack.
Here's how it works. You walk into Walmart, go to the electronics section, ask for iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system, and select the new Silver Unlimited plan. They'll smile because it's a good plan. You get real unlimited data all for just $20 a month for the whole first year. Get it at Walmart or StraightTalk.com. Straight Talk. Less dollars, more sense. Taxes and fees apply. Requires activation of iPhone 12 and a new Silver Unlimited plan or higher end auto pay enrollment. $25 a month service credit applied for up to 12 months if eligibility requirements are met. For network management practices, visit StraightTalk.com.
radiohealthjournal.com.
The Radio Health Journal podcast gives listeners the latest news on what's trending in health, science, technology, and more.
Certainly, we all want to see suicide prevention, and I'm certain that it does work to a degree. It's when I hear that all suicides are preventable that it makes me bristle, because they are not.
Featuring medical experts who break down complex topics in a way that's easy to understand. Radio Health Journal podcast, available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at radiohealthjournal.org.
And that's Viewpoints for this week. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming shows. And find a library of past programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. Plus, you'll always find previous segments and more information about our guests at viewpointsradio.org. Join us again next week for another edition of Viewpoints.
You're listening to Radio Health Journal, the trusted news source for medicine, science, and technology. I'm Elizabeth Westfield.
I'm Mayan Vosta-Betancourt.
And I'm Greg Johnson. This week, the playful move that could really harm your kid.
You can never rapidly pull on a child's wrist, even if they're doing the most fun move in the world when you're swinging them around by the wrists.
But first, not everyone has that little voice inside their head.
They don't really form visual images. They don't really have much inner speech. And so then the question arises, like, what does thinking feel like to them?
All that and more this week on Radio Health Journal.
Total Wireless is made to totally keep up with you. We now have unlimited data that never slows you down. Covered by the Verizon 5G network. And for less than $30 a month, we make your phone your ride or die. Switch now and pick a free 5G phone with qualified plan purchase. And your fourth line at no additional cost. Visit your local Total Wireless store today. Total Wireless, we're totally with you. Actual speeds may vary by location. For data management practices, see TotalWireless.com.
Each week on the Viewpoints Radio podcast, you'll hear from our leading experts on an important topic within education, history, society, psychology, and more.
When you have lawmakers that create systematic policies that are really only set up to favor people with deep pockets, then you have the rise of corporate industry taking over.
Viewpoints Radio podcast is produced by our team of award-winning journalists. Subscribe today by searching Viewpoints Radio wherever you listen to podcasts.
From eye color to accents, humans have a lot of variations. Many of them are obvious and used as a way of expressing individuality. But there are some major ones that many of us never realize, which are called hidden differences. How we think is considered to be one of these variable factors. Most of us assume that what's going on inside our own heads is the same as the person next to us. But Dr. Gary Lupien says we only assume that because there's not an obvious way to compare how we think.
We know that some people can run really fast. We get a lot of observation, you know, and people are kind of well calibrated. They know kind of how fast they run compared to others. We don't have the same type of access to other people's mental states. And so we don't know how much inner speech someone experiences or how much visual imagery one experiences. We can talk about it. We can compare notes. So it's stuff that we can reflect on, we can talk about. And then people are shocked to discover that, oh, these things differ.
Lupien is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His lab has been investigating the mind's inner voice. We all have one, right? Not so much. While there's not a ton of research on it just yet, it's believed that a person's inner voice exists on a spectrum, from someone who's constantly talking in their head to a person who doesn't hear any voice at all. And though there's been no real evidence that can point to what contributes to where each one of us lands on the spectrum, Lupien thinks it may be a combination of genetic predisposition and the culture you were raised in.
Inner speech, we know, does develop. It has a developmental trajectory. So before you learn, as a child, before you learn language, there's no inner speech. But then just based on observation of kids, you know, some kids talk to themselves out loud quite a bit and others less so.
We don't yet know if these observations in childhood remain the same as people get older. But Lupien says that it is pretty consistent over small amounts of time, like 6 months.
culture is the other factor that he believes could be an important influence.
To what extent is even speaking out loud to yourself kind of tolerated, encouraged, or is it seen as kind of abnormal behavior? One can view silent inner speech as in the same category as actually talking out loud to yourself, right? And so if you have an environment where talking out loud to yourself is encouraged, one might predict that there would be more silent inner speech overall.
While that's still a hypothesis, we do know that people with more inner speech also tend to have more visual imagery. That connection has led Lupien to assume that the opposite is also true.
And so what that means is that you have some people who report experiencing neither, right? So they don't really form any visual images. They don't really have much inner speech. And so then the question arises, like, what does thinking feel like to them? We have collected some self-report data on this, and many people report thinking in various spatial terms. So space is not visual. It's a more general thing, right? So people come up with all kinds of spatial ways of categorizing things, of sequencing things.
For example, one participant in Lupien's research said that they categorize information by placing the data into mental buckets.
And these places don't need to have names, right? You don't need to visualize them. You don't need to visualize a bucket, right? It's a more abstract way of organizing information.
Another way to understand how differently people think is through mental math.
So you can give them a problem and then have them kind of think aloud protocol. And there's a whole range of ways people do this. And it for sure is informed by how they were taught in school. But people on their own come up with all kinds of little shortcuts and things that they don't really think about or consider, like, how common is it? Does everyone do this?
The researchers were initially inspired to use this method by a post on the internet, where the user wrote that they tap their teeth as a way to help them add up numbers.
This is something that would never, I think, occur to a math cognition person studying, like, mental arithmetic, you know, that this is a strategy that people come up with. But it's a nonverbal thing, right? It's just they're tapping their teeth to kind of remember, you know, where, you know, carry the one and so on. And there is just such a diversity of these types of strategies and just ways of solving problems, right, that until you start exploring the space, it just doesn't occur to you.
These type of experiments show that there's a whole spectrum of strategies that people use every day without realizing how unique they may be, which makes it an exciting research path. Unfortunately, it can be challenging to study since describing how you think can be difficult to put into words.
Not surprisingly, if someone experiences a lot of inner speech, you ask them, well, how are you thinking? You know, they have a ready-made answer. It's like, well, it's kind of like I speak. So I use words in my mind. I sequence them into sentences. For someone who reports not really using language, it, not surprisingly, is harder to talk about because we don't really have the vocabulary to talk about these sorts of spatial transformations of meaning. But it's, I think, one productive research area is, again, focusing on behavioral tasks and understanding, okay, you know, here is a range of tasks that become easier if you kind of think about them in a more verbal-like way. Here are some tasks that would become harder if you think about it in a more verbal-like way, but maybe easier if you spatialize them.
And based on the results, the researchers will be able to start pinpointing characteristics of people with more or less inner voice. As you can imagine, studying this phenomenon has been slow work. Russ Hurlburt has been a pioneer of researching the inner experience of humans. But since most of this work is based on self-reports, it can be tricky to get accurate data.
And you have people who say, oh yeah, I talk to myself all the time, but then it turns out that, well, it's actually much rarer than that when you actually probe it in more detail. So it's a subjective phenomenon. And so one has to kind of trust people's self-report in one way or another. And that's not that different from other kinds of subjective things, right? So if we want to know whether someone is in pain, we ask them, we trust their response.
However, there are certain methods that are better than others. For example, you can use different experiments as a way to validate the self-reports.
If someone is saying, talking about tapping their teeth, right, a straightforward prediction is that, like, putting a pen in their mouth would get in the way of them solving math problems, And until you know that there are people who do this, it wouldn't occur to you to run that kind of experiment. If someone is using space to kind of put things into different categories, you can have them do the task while they have to hold something spatial in memory and kind of putting a memory load on spatial memory. And you would expect that it would interfere with their performance of the task, but not with someone who is doing it in a more language-focused way. So those are the kinds of experiments you can do to tease that apart. So it's always good if that subjective report predicts other things. And so this recent paper does that with inner speech. So it doesn't just show that, oh, there are these differences in self-reports. It also tries to show that, and these differences predict certain behaviors, certain performance on various cognitive tasks.
Lupien's recent paper, published in Psychological Science, used similar experiments to try and see if not having an inner voice has an effect on individual performance. There were two tasks that revealed a clear difference in performance for those who don't have much inner speech. The first test asked participants to remember certain words.
It's well known that when people are asked to remember a series of words, they tend to rehearse the sounds of those words, so-called phonological memory. And so a straightforward prediction is that someone who experiences less inner speech might be less likely to do that and as a result have worse memory. And so that's what we found. So people with less inner speech had a harder time remembering these words.
However, if participants chose to repeat the words out loud, they performed the same as the group with a strong inner voice. The second experiment asked both groups to quickly decide if two different objects rhymed.
See a picture of a box and a fox. Do these things rhyme? And we found the same pattern that people overall with less inner speech were worse at the task, but if they spoke out loud to themselves, their performance was at the same level as people with typical inner speech. And again, for those with typical inner speech, it didn't matter.
It's important to keep in mind that while this study shows consistent results, Lupien says there's no evidence that a lack of inner voice is associated with deficits across the board.
You know, one can come up with tasks where the prediction is flipped, where they would be expected to perform better. So, for example, when phonological activation gets in the way, which sometimes happens during reading certain words, you'd expect people with less inner speech to do better. There is also, in other work, we found that often people with more inner speech are slower without being more accurate. Language in general can be quite slow compared to other ways of thinking.
In fact, people who think spatially are often better suited for certain careers, like math-based professions, than those who think with language.
This isn't just mathematicians. We were looking at research psychologists who tend to use more mathematical methods, mathematical models.